This is Stealing Home. I'm David Temple. Hal Chase reinvented the way baseball was played. Maybe not at the plate, though he was a career 291 hitter, but he played defense like no one before him. Chase made his major league debut in 1905. During that time, first base was usually reserved for lumbering sluggers. Managers needed their bats, so they put them where they thought these not-so-nimble fielders would hurt the team the least. There are still weak fielders at first base today, don't get me wrong, but some first basemen have been lauded for their defense, and rightfully so. They're not all statues out there. But in the early 1900s, all of them were pretty much useless in the field. All of them, except for Hal Chase. I don't know if the term range existed in Chase's day, but if it did, his would have been described as incredible. Since he was so quick, he could cover first base faster than anyone else. This allowed him to play farther from the bag and cover more ground in the field. He would race down the line to field a bunt, taking the pressure off the catcher, or, God forbid, the pitcher, to make the play. He pioneered the act of running into the outfield and acting as the cutoff man. He'd make flashy plays at first, or at least make plays at first as flashy as they could be. He was, for all intents and purposes, a superstar. But Hal Chase had demons. He got in contract disputes and would defect from teams at the end of the season to play with so-called outlaw leagues. He would get in scraps with managers and was known to be a bit pouty. But he could always play ball. That is, when he wanted to. When Chase was upset about something, he would purposefully make poor fielding plays. He was such a good fielder, though, that he often made his miscues look as if it were another player's fault. Rumors swirled about Chase's misdoings, but nothing was proven. Then, at some point, Chase decided that he could use his gifts at appearing ungifted as a way to make money. He no longer botched plays out of some sort of angst, but to change the outcome of games and get paid by the gamblers who bet on his team to lose. Yankees manager Frank Chance had such a strong suspicion, one he couldn't prove, that in 1914 he shipped Chase off to, wait for it, the White Sox. This was before Shoeless Joe even joined the team, but the coincidence is still one that raises an eyebrow. Chase would eventually fall out of favor in Chicago, too, after some legal battles when he tried to defect to the newly formed Federal League. He would eventually catch on for a spell with the Reds, where he was accused of more cheating by manager Christy Mathewson. He would have a trial of sorts, but would eventually beat the rap due to a lack of evidence. He would, in the end, be blackballed from the game, bounce around different independent teams as a player and manager, and die in his home state of California at the age of 64. Chase's story mirrors that of Joe Jackson's a bit in that they were both great players that could have been Hall of Famers if not for their indiscretions. But Jackson became almost a reluctant hero of sorts. As the stories became more evident, he turned into a vessel of pity. He was just a nice guy who got caught up in some bad stuff and had his promising career cut short. No one felt bad for Hal Chase, because, like a sort of villain in a comic book, he used his powers for evil. He had a chance to make a difference, and instead chose greed and corruption. Chase played his last pro season the same year as the Black Sox scandal. He and the Black Sox were paramount in the resistance movement to clean up the game. But baseball had a hard time shaking its reputation as a corrupt sport. Gambling has taken down many people. Gamblers, players, bookies, and the like. Lives have been ruined. People have been killed. TV and movies have portrayed big gambling rings as run by big, powerful, scary people. And perhaps rightfully so. But when you look at a picture of Hal Chase, with his handsome face and his old-time puffy uniform, you don't see a monster. You see a ball player. Not a baseball player, but a ball player. A guy who is at the front lines of the sport. We should think of him fondly, but we can't. because he's a big part of the darker side of the game. From the Jose Lima Memorial Studios in Minneapolis, Minnesota, this is Stealing Home. I'm your host, David Temple. In this episode, we take a look at gambling. I talk to Wall Street trader turned gambler Joe Pita about the changes he made in his life, career, and the way he thought about baseball. Then contributor Sam Dingman discusses how his Baltimore Orioles mix with his gambling and his affection for terrible puns. Then I make a case for perhaps the most famous baseball gambler with the MVP of my heart. It's all coming up on Stealing Home. Let's play ball. A former guest of Stealing Home, Jonah Carey, has a book about the 2008 Tampa Bay Rays. It chronicles the change in ownership and front office personnel previous to their breakout season. Their ownership group were Wall Street guys. They liked baseball, had the money, and so they bought a fledgling baseball team and used their economic smarts to turn the Rays into a contender. This is becoming a growing trend in sports front offices and has spread to football and basketball as well. And while some might scoff at pencil pushers running sports teams, it makes sense to me. Wall Street traders, love them or hate them, are usually the smartest people in the room. Their job is basically entirely about proving that, in fact. But the smartest guys, even if they want an in sports, don't have to go the front office route. They have other ways to prove how smart they are. Take Joe Pita, for instance.
This is Joe Pita, and I'm the author of Trading Bases, a story about Wall Street, gambling, and baseball.
Joe was a Wall Street guy until an unfortunate turn of events left him without his job, access to his family, or anything to occupy his time.
Well, it really turned out that, you know, I made the transition, you know, really by accident, and it was literally, you know, by an accident. I was 2 years ago, I was starting my 15th year on Wall Street as a trader. And I got run over by an ambulance while I was a pedestrian in New York City. And the resulting leg injury left me in a wheelchair for a couple months. And worse than that, it left me unable to work. And then worse than that, it left me stranded 3,000 miles away from my family, which were back in San Francisco, because I couldn't fly. So I had to stay in New York and rehab my leg. And while I did, I was bored, and I was in pain, and I was sitting in my apartment and, you know, probably feeling depressed and a little bit sorry for myself. And that was about when spring training came around, and I started to kind of throw myself into that spring instead of just reading a sabermetric preview, really trying to understand them. And then before long, I started building, you know, opening up my PC and building my own spreadsheet. And I realized as I was doing it that, man, this is very similar to the, you know, kind of model building I used when I was valuing a company that we'd use when, you know, we were trading stocks. And I thought to myself, well, I know what I'd do if I found a stock that I thought was under or overvalued. Why don't I apply that same logic to baseball? And I just kept tinkering with the model and kept, you know, I was really fascinated by it, and the best part was I started waking up in the morning, you know, with that same sort of enthusiasm I had for trading stocks. I wanted to get over to the computer and, you know, start projecting, keep working on my projections all spring. And that was really how it started.
Joe Pita, former Wall Street trader, used his smarts and passion for analytics and turned himself into Joe Pita, baseball gambler. And his Wall Street experience helped him in ways beyond his eye for analytics.
Well, certainly working on a trading desk on Wall Street, you know, I used to be fond of saying that the second most popular person on any trading desk behind the behind the intern that would get chicken parm sandwiches for lunch every day for the desk. The second popular person is the local bookie, because, you know, just about any trading desk. New York is still a very popular. Let's see, the neighborhood bookie is still a very prominent figure in New York City, or at least it was within the Wall Street circles I was in. So I was no stranger to the world of betting on football games, and that kind of talk would dominate the workplace. And I never kidded myself, and I mentioned this in the book, I never kidded myself that that sort of endeavor was gambling as entertainment. I knew that in the long run, I was going to be a net payer. And all my friends were. And I kind of viewed that as no different from, hey, in the long run, we're all going to be net spenders on movies, and we're going to be net spenders on video games. And I kind of viewed gambling as entertainment as falling into that same category. So I was certainly familiar, you know, with that. But as I started looking at the baseball season, I really started to think, okay, if I think I have an edge, I'm going to approach this differently. I'm going to treat this as an investment, and I'm going to start using the same capital allocation principles that I used as a hedge fund trader, and I'm going to approach it from that standpoint. In other words, you know, the whole thing that you're always trying to do when you trade stocks is if you have an edge, put a small amount of money on it and then try to repeat that hundreds of times over the course of a year. And the baseball season really is perfect for that, unlike any other sport. So that's really how my mind sort of shifted from, hey, I'm going to bet, you know, on my alma mater because it's fun, to, oh, I'm going to place a bet on the Pirates and the Braves today because I think I have maybe a 2% edge on the outcome, so I'm going to, you know, bet accordingly.
Joe does a great job of chronicling in his book how easy the transition came from stock trader to gambler. You have to have the right kind of mind to do both. You have to have a great attention to detail, an ability to think about the abstract, and you really need a set of brass stones, if you get my drift. There's a lot of emotion in baseball and gambling that needs to be checked at the door.
That's great training for that, because you really... I think that I, you know, look, I was not immune to when I'm watching a game, and if I have a bet on the game and it's getting down to late, you know, late in the game, I'm as nervous as, you know, anybody is. And I'm also not thinking, I also turn into an emotional viewer, and I'm not thinking about, you know, small sample sizes and things like that. I'm thinking about, you better get this guy out, you know. So in that sense, it's no different. But yes, playing poker and trading stocks, those are all endeavors where after a while, if you take emotion out of it, you actually learn that you're better at it when you take emotion out of the equation.
And Joe could leave emotion out because he had faith in his model. He knew that given enough games, he could prove that he had the edge over the bookmakers.
I think that the biggest edge that my model had over the Las Vegas bookmakers is really lineup changes. Because I think they get it right when a big-name player is out of the lineup. If, say, you know, 2 hours before a game, Ryan Braun is going to be rested. The line adjusts accordingly. And generally, I find that they get big changes like that right. However, there are a lot of other lineup changes on the margin that can have almost as much impact but really aren't recognized. And I really talk in the book. I mentioned some of those in the book. During the 2011 season, the Minnesota Twins lineup was racked by injuries as the season went on. And there were times when Trevor Plouffe, who would be, you know, at the time was a light-hitting backup shortstop, even though he's now moved over to third. At the time, he was really a below-replacement-level hitting shortstop. And he would sub for Justin Morneau in the lineup. And really still at the beginning of that season. Morneau was still a premier corner-hitting first baseman. And it wasn't obvious when lineups would come out that that was so, because the Twins were doing a lot of shifting. Maurer might move over to first base. Kadire was moving from the outfield to the infield. And you actually had to sort of look at the marginal change and realize, oh, this is really Trevor Plouffe for Justin Morneau. And that is a 50 or 60 run a year difference in the Minnesota lineup, which means that their win probability for this game should shift maybe 4 or 5%. And it just wasn't – Vegas really didn't account for that. And, you know, when you start doing that for every game and every lineup, I really think that is where, you know, my model had an edge. And it might only be 1% or 2% a game, but, again, that's the whole thing. There's 2,400 games played a year. If you can get a 1% or 2% edge, oh, that's significant. That's not much different than the house has on a roulette wheel. And, you know, the whole model for owning a roulette wheel is spin that wheel a couple thousand times over the course of a month, and you will make money in the long run.
The system for betting on baseball is a little different than the system for betting on football or basketball. And it may be the reason why baseball ranks well behind football and basketball in the number of bets placed.
I think it's twofold. I think that the lack of a point spread or viewing thing, because baseball does not have a point spread when you bet on it. It's simply a money line. And ironically, that is a better setup for somebody who is model-based, because a money line is essentially a win expectancy price that Vegas puts on it. And what happens is their win expectancy, and this is why people should be betting on baseball if they are doing it to make money. I always like to look when I say, okay, what's the house edge? And I always kind of look at it like this. What are they selling $100 bills for? And in a football game, in a football bet, they're essentially selling $100 bills for a little more than $104. In other words, that when you bet, you know, in other words, they collect $110 for each bet. They're going to, so they collect if two people bet on both sides of the game, and they each bet $110 to win $100, the casino's collecting $220, and they're going to pay out $210. So that, essentially, you break that down to a $100 bet, and the math is 11 divided by 21. Essentially, they're selling $100 for about $104. In baseball, they sell that $100 bill for about half that. So it's closer to, it's less than 102. So that the house egg you can see right there is a lot smaller to begin with. And when you're dealing with that, when you're dealing with money line instead of a point spread, it's a much easier thing to model as well. Because, hey, they might be coming up with the Reds as a 60% chance of winning. If I have them coming up at 62, well, right away I very easily know. I'm like, okay, that's a 2% edge. I know how to allocate my capital accordingly. And so I find that baseball should, if people are trying to make money, to me, baseball is much, there's a much bigger advantage to bet on it. And then, ultimately, the other part that differs from basketball and football is, because there's no point spread, I know that every player on the field and every manager, Ron Washington excepted, is trying to do the exact same thing that I have bet on, which is win the game. And that is not true in basketball, or football especially. If I've bet on a team to win, if I bet on the Giants to win by 10 points and they're up 6 late in the game with the ball deep in the opponent's territory, their goal is to run out the clock. Or maybe their goal is to kick a field goal to go up by 2 points. That runs counter to what I've bet on them to do. That never happens in baseball because, you know, if I bet on them to win, the players and the manager are trying to achieve that goal.
If you're confused, don't worry. And don't let that discourage you from reading Joe's book either, because while it may get technical at some points, it's about a whole lot more than gambling. It's about a guy finding his way through some new waters, about thinking in different ways. And though it might sound a little cheesy, it's about a guy rediscovering his love for baseball.
In the more sort of whimsical, amusing way, there were certainly times when later in the season when I came back to San Francisco, and, you know, my wife knew exactly what endeavor I was doing. And she would walk into our, in our television room, and I'd have, you know, let's say the Phillies were playing the Pirates, and she'd say, she's not a baseball fan, and she'd sort of be vaguely aware of what's going on, and she'd look, and then she'd look at me and look up at the screen and say, "Are you rooting against the Phillies?" And I would say, and I always used to quote, you know, I used to think about that line from the Mark Cohn song, "Walking in Memphis." I'd just look at her and say, "Ma'am, I am tonight." And so, it, in that sense, it could change my emotion on a game-to-game basis. But honestly, David, what I found was, and I really go into this in the book, immersing myself back in baseball in a way that I hadn't done since I was a teenager actually helped me rediscover my love for the game. And back when I was a teenager, you know, I appreciated the baseball game as a game that I played. I played it constantly, whether it was in the backyard after dinner in the neighborhood wiffle ball games that went on all summer until it was dark, to playing Little League, to playing high school baseball, to thinking that it was going to be my profession when I grew up. So I kind of enjoyed baseball from that, you know, from a playing obsession. What I found, you know, 30 years later was I actually found myself obsessed with the game in the same way, again, as a fan. And yes, it might have been from an analytics standpoint, but that same love of the game was still there. And it really deepened my love for the game. And I try to address that in one of the last chapters of the book, when I really sort of take on that argument that, you know, that you, that cliche that, oh, they love their spreadsheets more than they do the game. And I have a chapter in the book where, you know, I hope I debunk that, or at least from my standpoint, I hope that people would realize, oh, it's not the gambling, it's not the it's not even the, you know, the thrill of solving a puzzle. At the root of it all, it's still baseball.
Joe takes the reader down different paths throughout the season, pivoting from personal stories to winning strategies. And while the stories are interesting, way more interesting than you'd expect in a book about gambling, you also get a lot of free advice about betting on baseball, something Joe didn't mind giving away.
Well, people have asked me why, and this is a fair question, and I'll kind of address that, that people say, why would you write this book? Why would you, quote, give away your secrets? And the answer is that it really was a story more than anything else. And honestly, it's also not a viable business or money-making endeavor at this point. And so as I got to the epilogue of the book, I actually go to Vegas and for the 2012 season, take an actual pool of money that was started with my publisher suggesting that I go to Vegas with their marketing budget, and the publisher being Penguin, and bet on games for the 2012 season. And I did that, and it really turned into more or less a case study on, is this a viable investment vehicle? And while in some ways it could be, it's not right now. And it's really not, because the market's not deep enough. And even if, you know, as I said to, in fact, I was talking to Brian Kenny about this, who interviewed me on his radio show. He's like, "Joe, explain that to me." He said in 2012 you were up 14% and you did it on $1 million fund. So that's an earnings, you know, that's $140,000. That's not small change. And I said, "You're absolutely right, Brian. But think about it from a money management standpoint. That $1 million wasn't mine. You know, I'm managing that for that's other people's money. And the way the money management business works is generally you get, you know, hedge fund managers, they get 20% of what, you know, somebody, what they make for their customers. So in that case, we're talking about $28,000. And that is not enough, you know, for someone to live on. And I said, additionally, I couldn't, and here's the problem with the way the market exists now, my returns wouldn't be scalable if I did anything more than double the fund. In other words, I couldn't raise 10 times that money and go to Vegas, because the market isn't deep enough there to take 10 times the bets I was making. Maybe I could have doubled my bets. So in other words, the returns aren't scalable. So honestly, if you were to say what in your dream scenario would be next, it would be working with the other side of the counter in Las Vegas to try to expand this market for all of the Nate Silver-like model builders who are out there. There are people a lot smarter than me. I'm not an engineer, and you know, the spreadsheets I built were about the limits of my statistics, addled mind. There are a lot smarter people than me working out there who could probably improve on my model tremendously. And there, it would be nice if there were a vehicle for them to be able to more or less bet against each other. And I think Vegas could do a huge job, and this is what I really write about in the epilogue. I think Vegas could do a much better job at facilitating such a marketplace. And because it looks very familiar to me to what Wall Street and NASDAQ trading looked like when I started there 20 years ago. So honestly, if I were to say what's next, I'd love to work with that side of the counter. And I have talked with some casinos. Nothing's come out of it, but I really believe someday that market is going to change tremendously. And what I did on, that I sort of wrote a book about, people are going to do as a profession someday in the future.
That day hasn't come yet for Joe, but it might someday. And when it does, I hope he writes another book about it, because his first is a very interesting read. When people talk about Moneyball these days, they usually end up talking about way more than what the original book actually entails. Moneyball wasn't a book about how to win baseball games. It was a book about a general manager trying new and innovative ways to win baseball games. That's what I liked so much about it the first time I read it. Billy Beane was trying to find justice in an unjust world. He was trying to make his own luck. And that's what Joe Pita did too. His book isn't a manual on how to become a profitable baseball gambler. It deals with him and his struggles to find normalcy and truth in both his life and the way he thinks about his favorite game. Joe Pita's book is called Trading Bases, a story about Wall Street, gambling, and baseball, and is available now at all major bookstores. You can visit his website at tradingbases.squarespace.com and follow him on Twitter at MagicRatSF. No matter what team you follow, there have been seasons where that team hasn't given you a whole lot of reasons to go to the ballpark. Contributor Sam Dingman is an Orioles fan and has felt that plight, until recently at least. But that didn't stop him from showing up. Because though the team may have been bad, he found other opportunities for enjoyment. Opportunities that stem from his love for cringe-inducing humor. Here's Sam Dingman.
I play low-stakes poker occasionally with some friends, and we have one house rule. If you're going to fold, you have to make a pun on the word fold. For example, you might remark, seemingly in passing, that your favorite song is Fold Man River, or that your favorite variety of pretzel is Fold Gold before discarding your hand. The Nora Jones fans in our number often find themselves wondering why they're unable to ease my worried mind or melt my fold-fold heart. Our coalition of Bob Seger acolytes, upon finding themselves bid out of a pot, might tout their nostalgia for fold-time rock and roll. Since many of us also harbor a secret affection for soap operas, we've sometimes considered calling our motley crew of Texas Hold'em enthusiasts the Fold and the Beautiful. Periodically, we invite other folks to join our game, and they've often raised objections to the pun rule. Why, they wonder, can't people with bad hands just bow out quietly? What is this obsessive need to infuse the game with gallows humor? The answer to that has a lot to do with the fact that I've spent the last 23 years of my life with the unenviable task of rooting for the Baltimore Orioles. When you make the curious choice to root for a team like the Orioles, or the Pirates, or the Padres, or the Royals, or the Cubs, you reach a point where you no longer watch games because you hope your team's going to win. You know the odds are heavily against that particular outcome. But you roll the dice anyway, because the richest parts of the game have nothing to do with winning and losing. In any given Orioles radio broadcast, there are a number of moments that I look forward to almost as much as an at-bat by Adam Jones with runners on or an attempted steal of second base against Matt Wieters. Those are great baseball moments, to be sure, but they still don't feel totally natural to expect. Their advent is fairly recent, and for the years of futility that preceded them, I instead joined other Orioles fans in anxiously awaiting the Roma sausage ad for their trademark Chorizo sausage. We'd shout, "Oh!" along with the narrator, and then hope that the next spot featured the continuing adventures of the Royal Farms coffee detective, who is consistently bedeviled in his quest to find out what on earth those other convenience stores put in their giant urns that makes their coffee taste so much worse than Royal Farms Brazilian dark roast. Seasons Pizza loves to remind us that there are so many reasons to go to Seasons, after which my friend Alan and I have a long-standing tradition of turning to one another to add, "And yet so few to go to Camden Yards." It never gets old to watch Brian Mattis give up a go-ahead home run and then break into a rousing round of "I can't get no Mattis faction," or following a fifth-inning meltdown by Wei-Yin Chen to loudly wonder, "Are you not chentertained?" Our hearts leap at that sacred moment in the seventh inning when Orioles telecaster Gary Thorne reminds us that the broadcast is sponsored by Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and that we should please drink responsibly. His delivery so delightfully undermining the message and goading us to gleefully disregard his instructions. When it comes to poker, I imagine there are other gamblers like me who certainly enjoy winning when it happens, but take just as much pleasure in twirling the chips between their fingers, clinking the ice cubes in their whiskey, smoking cheap cigars, and analyzing the behavior of their fellow players for tells. In addition to the puns in our game, I relish the knowledge that Ben will only bet if he has at least a pair, Garrett only talks if he has bad cards, Marshall frowns and strokes his goatee when he has a good hand, and you can always tell when I have a straight because I tap my fingertips against the table as I count it off in my head. In the way that gamblers love details like those and countless others, I've come to treasure the shape and texture of Orioles baseball much more than its objective quality in terms of wins and losses. In Las Vegas, they hide the clocks and give you gin and tonics for free. In my apartment, on certain Sunday evenings, we wax nostalgic about Eddie Murphy's work in the seminal film The Folden Child, acknowledge that Mitchell Hurwitz honed his comedic voice with his early writing on The Folden Girls, and fondly recall the first time our parents read us the story of Foldilocks and the Three Bears. For hard luck baseball fans from Baltimore to Kansas City to Chicago to San Diego to Pittsburgh and beyond, we can safely gamble our emotional well-being on the fate of promising prospects and aging free agents, knowing that even when they let us down, the sausage puns are what'll keep us coming back every night of every summer.
Sam Dingman is an Orioles fan and a podcaster. He's the co-host of the very excellent Baltimoreans podcast. You can find that by searching Baltimoreans on iTunes or by going to the website baltimoreanspodcast.com. You can also follow him on Twitter at Sam Dingman. We end every episode by taking a look at someone who, for actions on the field or off, deserve a little love. It's the MVP of my heart. It's hard to say that someone like Pete Rose deserves a little love, if any. Pete Rose did some bad things. The thing that sticks out most, of course, is Rose's affiliation with gambling. I won't rehash the details, because they are heavily documented, but I do want to make a case for him, though I realize that this take is also easily findable. In the interest of full disclosure, I will mention that I love Pete Rose, so I'm obviously biased. His hit record is certainly a great feat, but it goes much deeper for me. Rose played the same way we would if we were suddenly given a chance to do so. He'd be the first to tell you that he didn't have as much talent as many of his teammates. He made his way out of determination and will. Because he loved baseball. He loved it more than any of us could ever love it. He was the fiercest competitor and the first to tell you so. And his competitiveness brought out a very bad side of him. After the Black Sox scandal of 1919, baseball employed its first commissioner, Judge Kennesaw Mountain Landis. Landis was known to rule with an iron fist. His face kind of even looked like an iron fist, so to speak. His first order of duty as commissioner was to ban all involved with the fixing of the World Series from baseball. Ban them for life. At the time, it was a welcome sentence. People were outraged, and rightfully so, that gambling had infiltrated the sport so heavily. But it set a precedent. A precedent that, to this day, haunts Pete Rose. Rose bet on baseball. Worse, he bet on his own team. He always maintained that he had bet on his team to win, but it didn't matter. He was caught. He was banned. And then, he continued to lie about his involvement. That was perhaps his death knell. Had he come clean, maybe, he would have seen some leniency. But he didn't until many years later. And so the all-time leader in games played, at-bats, and hits, the man who personified hard-nosed baseball, a 17-time All-Star, is banned. He can't manage, he can't be in a front office, and, according to the museum at least, he can't be in the Hall of Fame. I think it's time to take a second look at Pete Rose. I understand his punishment, and I think it hit him harder than people realize. The Machine, a book by Joe Posnanski, recounts the season of the 1975 Reds. It's tremendous. And there's an afterword of sorts about Rose. Rose spends his days now in Vegas. He makes his living selling autographs. In the history of man, Rose could have had it worse. But the way he lives now, the shadow and the cloud that hangs over him, as a fan, it's almost too much to bear. Baseball has had a complicated history of punishments. Players accused of drunken driving and domestic abuse getting off scot-free comes to mind. Again, I understand Rose's punishment, but I'm having a harder time believing that that punishment fits the crime. Rose did a short-lived reality TV series. In it, his wife and adopted kids take a trip to the Hall of Fame. They see the bat Rose used when he broke Cobb's record. They see his jerseys and photos of him line the place. But they don't see his plaque. And his wife breaks down and cries. It may have been for TV, but I don't see it that way. I honestly couldn't see much of anything. Because I was crying as well. Pete Rose is a complicated guy who made a mistake. He will be the first to admit it. But the Hall of Fame is stuffed with guys who made all kinds of mistakes. Baseball calls to us because it's played by guys who, more than any other sport, seem the most like us. It's a skill game. Made for fat people, skinny people, tall, short, handsome, and dopey-looking people. It's played by humans. And humans are complicated. We make mistakes. When we get caught, we take our lumps. But we get another shot at it. And Pete Rose should too. And he sits and waits for it, quietly. Just like we may be looking for a second chance at a career or a relationship, he's looking for another shot at the Hall of Fame. This whole situation has humbled him, it seems. For once, he isn't pushing. He isn't trying to beat the odds by just trying harder. he's doing the best he can to look less like the man that got him into this mess. And because he's doing his best, and because I know it's killing him inside, Pete Rose is the MVP of my heart. Stealing Home is written, hosted, and produced by me, David Temple. A special thanks to Joe Pita and Sam Dingman. To find out more about the show or to get show notes for this episode or any other episode, visit stealinghome.org. You can follow us on Twitter at stealinghome.org and visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/stealinghomeradio. And if you like the show, please tell your friends about it. Share it with them on Facebook or send them a link to the website in an email. More listeners equals a bigger show, and a bigger show draws bigger guests, and bigger guests make for better stories for you. So please, tell your friends. Stealing Home is on iTunes, so feel free to subscribe, and if you like the show, make sure to rate and review it. It helps us look better to the iTunes crowd. That's it for this episode of Stealing Home. Until next time, I'm David Temple.